Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, and this week's show, as always, is going to be a good one. This one in particular is very close to my heart. The speaker that we're going to be talking with today, her name is Rae Sikora, and she's been involved in the animal rights, human rights, and environmental movements for over 25 years, and she's the kind of person that, you know, you're just around her and you feel calmer and more at peace, and that's what she's all about, and trying to help people on their journeys to be better activists and just happier individuals in the world as well, even in the face of learning about so much horrible stuff. So Rae Sikora is going to be on later in the hour, but first, before we get to speak with her, we're going to do some news, and I'm very happy to introduce to you, our Animal Voices listeners, the rotating news spokesperson, Sue. And Sue, if you could just give us a little bit of introduction and then jump into the news, that would be great.
Sure, that's great. Thanks, Lauren. My name's Sue Teubner, and I currently do a lot of work with Farm Sanctuary down in the States. Just recently held the first walkathon for them up here. Myself and my partner, Jim Lonson, we are the co-founders of Ethical Treatment for Farm Animals, which is an organization designed basically to educate people about what goes on in the farming community and factory farming. And also we're organizing something called the FAN, which is the Farm Animal Network, which is going to be trying to link up vegetarian or vegan hobby farms who possibly have placements for farmed animals, that as we get information about possible rescues and that kind of thing, that we can place these animals on farms until such a time that we hopefully, maybe someday, in the near future, have a Farm Sanctuary Canada up here. So I'm happy to be here, though, and this is going to be great. It's going to be lots of fun.
Very ambitious, all these projects. And how was the walkathon?
Walkathon was great. We had a really good turnout, considering the weather was a little bit up and down and it did rain. But we had almost 40 people there, and everyone was very excited, enthusiastic, and so it was a lot of fun. And we raised over $1,500. For Farm Sanctuary, which
is
awesome.
That's super. We have to get you on the program as an interviewee, I think, sometime soon.
That would be great, definitely. So anyways, we'll get to the news now, though. First of all, just want to start off with letting you know that this year for Animal Action Week, which is running from October 4th to the 11th, the International Fund for Animal Welfare wants your pet to take action for abused and abandoned animals. They're asking that people send in a photo of your companion with the phrase "Pass Bill C-10B without change" written on it and your signature. These pictures are going to be gathered and delivered to the Senate, hopefully sending a message about how important this bill is to Canadians. As everyone may or may not know, the Senate currently wants to make changes to the bill that will weaken the bill so much that it's going to be better not to have passed it at all. On September 30th, the House of Commons sent the animal cruelty legislation back to the Senate. Despite opposition, the House of Commons firmly rejected the Senate's amendments to Bill C-10 and urged members of the chamber to follow their example. In a message to the Senate, the House wrote, "There is agreement in both houses on the need for cruelty to animals legislation to continue to recognize reasonable and generally accepted practices involving animals. After careful consideration, this House remains convinced that the bill should be passed in the form it approved on June 6, 2003. Members of Parliament offered strong arguments against each of the Senate's amendments, and the letter deemed most of the amendments unnecessary. The reason for this change is significant. This is the first amendment to the Criminal Code with respect to animal cruelty since 1892. It provides stronger sentencing options for those convicted of animal cruelty and offers equal protection for pets, strays, wildlife, and farm animals. If the law is passed, animal abusers would go to jail for up to 5 years and would face substantial fines and could even be banned from owning animals for life." And everyone, if you want to send in your photos, you can send them to the IFAW at 612-1 Nicholas Street in Ottawa, K1N7B7, or you can email Be Like Bob Cartwright, C-A-R-T-W-R-I-G-H-T at ifaw.org. And PETA is now protesting again. Last Thursday, just in time for Milan's Fashion Week, PETA launched a new ad campaign targeting Donatella Versace. The ads feature a most unflattering picture of the designer with the slogan, "Fur is worn by beautiful animals and ugly people." A small group of animal rights activists protested in front of the Versace flagship store in Milan. PETA's had no luck in its efforts to convince Donatella Versace to stop designing with fur, even after showing her hideous images of animals struggling in traps. So the animal rights group is hoping that to get her attention with a hideous image of herself. Last Friday, PETA members posing as clergy members stormed the runways of Dolce & Gabbana and Gianfranco Ferre's spring 2004 fashion shows in Milan as well. They pulled out banners reading, "Thou shall not kill. Don't wear fur." And if anyone is a fan of Jeffrey Mason, he is coming to town. Jeffrey Mason is the renowned author of several books, including When Elephants Weep, The Emotional Lives of Animals. His book's been translated into 18 languages and spent more than 37 weeks on Canada's national bestseller list, and it's now considered a classic. He's going to be here Thursday, November 6th at 7:30 at the ROM Theatre, and this is being presented by Zoo Check Canada and the World Society for the Protection of Animals. For anyone who hasn't heard, magician Roy Horn of Siegfried and Roy fame still remains in critical but stable condition Monday, 3 days after he was mauled by one of his rare white Bengal tigers during his Las Vegas stage show. The tiger grabbed him by the neck and dragged him off stage during a performance. These tigers, which Siegfried and Roy raised from cubs, are a signature part of their act. Siegfried and Roy become famous for their shows, which they say star wild animals. It's unknown what caused the attack, and this is the first attack on stage since the pair started performing for nearly half a century. The tiger, Montecore, who has appeared in the show for several years, was placed under quarantine at the Mirage Hotel following an attack. His ultimate fate remains unknown. Officials with the Humane Society of the United States said they had spoken to Horn several years ago about the dangers of untrained people keeping big cats as pets. And Wayne Pissell, who's the group's director, is quoted as saying, "When the best trained and most experienced handlers of big cats can be attacked and dragged around like rag dolls, it is plainly obvious that untrained private citizens should not keep big cats as pets." This comes after police in New York removed a 400-pound tiger from a New York apartment in a commando-style operation Saturday. They rappelled down the side of a building and shot the animal with tranquilizer darts through the window. Authorities were alerted after a man, who was later identified as the animal's owner, checked into a hostel saying he'd been bitten by a pit bull. Mm-hmm. Doctors quickly determined that this injury was not a dog bite. And there's a flock of flamingos who are going to be at the West Edmonton Mall. West Edmonton Mall has acquired 15 flamingos that they say will entertain and educate visitors to the mall. It's going to open before the end of October. The birds were transported to Edmonton last week from a conservation center in Langley, British Columbia, and are being kept in the basement until their exhibit is ready. This mall has a controversial history as a keeper of animals, particularly dolphins. Gary Hansen, the mall's general manager and chief operating officer, expects some people will object to captive flamingos. He's quoted as saying, "There are always a small few who oppose what you're doing. We don't bother reasoning with them or responding to them because they are incapable of reason." Thanks, Gary. In Langley, the flamingos were kept outdoors during summer months and indoors in winter. At the mall, they'll be kept indoors all year, but with better environmental controls, according to Doug Richardson, who's the curator of the Langley facility where the birds were brought in from. They will be exposed to the natural spectrum of light. Their water will be filtered. If anything, it's like an upmarket version of what they were kept in here. Tell that to the flamingos. Finally, we're going to end on a good note. A lone killer whale off of Canada's Pacific coast will be relocated back to U.S. waters, where it's hoped that he will join his family. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans announced Friday that it is accepting proposals from companies and groups with financial and expertise to help move the four-year-old orca and reunite him with his birth mother. The whale's name, who is Luna, was discovered swimming alone in Nootka Sound on the west coast of Vancouver Island in July 2001. Scientists are still trying to determine if Luna was accidentally separated from or forced to leave his family pod, which is known as L-Pod, more than 2 years ago. Lately, though, the orca has taken to hanging out near Gold River, but has had too much contact with humans, putting both people and himself at risk. A scientific panel recommended intervention last month after reports emerged that he had been injured by collisions with float planes and humans were becoming upset by his interfering with watercraft. Some onlookers have poured beer down his blowhole and tried to brush his teeth, and run-ins with the boats have left him with two gashes on his head, and he recently damaged his sailboat hull. Experts speculate that he is seeking the attention because he is lonely. The DFO plan is calling from Luna to be moved from Nootka Sound to Juan de Fuca Strait, where his family pod spends summer and fall, and where he will hopefully rejoin the pod with his mother, who now has a new calf. However, it's not known if his family pod will accept him back, and officials have warned that if the pod does not accept him, they will have to take more steps to protect him, since this strait has heavy marine traffic. The department's been quoted as saying, if it fails, DFO may need to consider other options, including captivity or other permanent means of dealing with Luna, whatever those means may be. But there is hope. Last year, officials reunited a young female orca found orphaned and injured near Seattle with her family pod, and she was reunited successfully. So hopefully Luna will find his way back home with his mom and his family, and it will be a happy reunion. And that's the news for now.
Well, thanks, Sue.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Animal Voices. We just heard from Sue, who is going to be every other week doing the news for Animal Voices, so it's going to be an ongoing segment of the show. We're going to hear some music by the Neutral Milk Hotel, and that's Soy Milk. Please stay tuned to Animal Voices. We're going to come back with humane educator, environmental educator, Ray Sikora. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. And today's program, we're going to be speaking with Ray Sikora, who is, I don't know exactly how to describe her. Sue and I were talking during the break that to say that she's an environmental or humane educator doesn't quite sum it up, because I think the message that she's trying to bring to a lot of people is one of compassion and peace, and it's really quite broad scale and maybe even transcends some issues. So it's a delight and an honor to have Ray on today. Ray, are you on the line?
I'm on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great.
Thanks for being here today in the middle of your moving. You're going off to Sweden.
I am.
Are you going to be doing educational work in Sweden as well? Are you continuing on this work there?
Yeah, I'm going to continue the same work, assuming that, you know, the work gets welcomed with open arms in Europe like it has been in North America. So, yeah, I'm going to take that leap of faith and do the same work.
So I gave kind of a roundabout introduction to who you are. How would you describe the work that you're doing in the world right now?
I could actually hear your roundabout introduction.
Okay.
So it was fun to listen to it because you have basically the same confusion that I had for years about how to describe what I do, because it doesn't fit neatly into environmentalism or animal rights or human rights or consumerism. It covers all of those and more. So it's always been a little bit tricky. Like, you know, when I'm flying on airplanes to go do a program somewhere and someone says, what do you do? You know, it's always this question. I wish I had a one-word answer, and I don't. And what I've come to saying is either that I do workshops in compassionate living, or I say I do workshops in nonviolence. And I prefer to say nonviolence in a way, because people assume, if they hear nonviolence, they assume that I'm just talking about people-to-people violence. And they don't include in nonviolence, oh, how do our actions affect other species or the environment or, you know, even other cultures. Most people just think, oh, right in their community or in their country. So I kind of like to say nonviolence, because then it opens up this whole discussion about who are we being violent toward.
One of the things that strikes me about, you know, the workshop that I took with you and the things that people have said about you is just by being around you, often people feel calmer and more at peace. And one of my struggles within the animal rights and environmental movements and the feminist movement, these different movements that I've been involved with, is you can see people struggling for change in specific areas, and sometimes we're not able to even treat each other very well in the course of doing that. So one of the things that I've really appreciated about your approach is that kind of interaction that we're having just in our organizing practices also counts.
Yeah, it's so important. I think that, you know, we often, we can look at what our work is and say, yes, I'm teaching about compassion and I'm teaching about peace. And then in our own homes or in our own offices or with our own partner, we can't even figure out how to do it. So a lot of the workshops that I've done lately also include communication workshops about how to communicate lovingly with even the people who you may think of as your adversary, and And the people, often the biggest challenge for people is the people closest to them. It's their families, it's their coworkers, it's their partners. Those are the biggest communication challenges. And so how do you show up in those situations and just be inviting, just be this inviting, loving example rather than pushing people? And so it's, and I think what brought a lot of my work around to that was seeing lots of angry activists. You know, people who are so passionate and coming from a very loving place. You know, when you see some of the dark corners of the planet, the things that are going on to all life, you can't help but feel a lot of emotion. For some people it's sad, and for some people it's angry. And when the people who have a lot of anger come at the people around them, they actually don't help other species at all or the environment. It does the opposite. People's defenses get really big and they shut them out. So it's really basic. I think that we all learn to just understand that we're all in a process. And I think what happens is if you know a lot about an issue, like animal rights or environmental issues, maybe you've been looking at it really closely for a long time. So I might meet someone, and I had a whole process to get where I got. It took me 47 years to arrive where I am now in terms of how I live and how I look at the world. And yet I'm talking to someone, and in 5 minutes I want them to understand what took me 47 years. You know, we don't have the patience to let someone else have the same process we had or their own process. So it just seems like it's really basic in terms of people feeling like they belong to this movement of compassion. You're not going to feel like you belong if somebody's telling you you're doing it all wrong, or you're too slow, or you're not good enough.
For me, the question around anger is such a complicated one. I mean, I came into a lot of politics initially through a partner who was or would be considered very hardcore, and I sort of felt that this person wouldn't love me anymore if I wasn't on board with all these different politics. And I sort of made a commitment to myself from that point onward that whenever I introduced people to whatever political thing, that I wouldn't do it in a way that would alienate them. But on the other hand, I think, too, for me, you know, initially coming into some of these politics through feminism and really seeing the importance of reclaiming anger and seeing anger as sort of as a motivating force. I remember reading a Buddhist text once that said that, you know, a lot of activists think that anger is the motivating force, but if they look deeper, they see that there is a well deeper than that. And this author was saying, and that's love. So do we draw from the anger or do we draw from the love? So how do you, you know, relate to that in terms of thinking through anger? And is the point to try to get rid of that in our activism or to try to use that in different ways?
I think it's impossible to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Because the reality is it's there. You know, we all have it. I have a ton of it. And just before you said anger can be a really good motivator, you said something like that, or can be a motivator, I was thinking that. I was thinking, well, yeah, anger isn't a bad thing. It motivates people to do amazing work in terms of social change and lots of other areas. So I don't think that it's about trying to make the anger go away. That's so pointless, because it's always going to show up. And I think the more that you try to make it go away, the more it shows up. So I think that it's looking at, yes, okay, I feel angry about this, and what can I do with this anger? I'm angry about it, and what's the most effective way for me to deal with this situation that's causing me so much anger? You know, like an example is I had this land in Minnesota, and there were hunters who would come and they'd hunt on the land. And it was posted, and it was posted in a very kind way that said, you're welcome to hike here and, you know, enjoy the land, but please, you know, no hunting. Mm-hmm. And then I had official, you know, legal hunting signs with that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hunting season would start, and they'd all show up. And I was so angry, you know, and a friend of mine said, just get a gun. You know, you want to deal with them, get a gun and go talk to them holding a gun. And I said, no, I don't think that's how I want to do it. You know, I want to do it in a different way. And yet I had a lot of anger. And so the first one who I talked to there, I just called it what it was. You know, I just said, look, you know, I am really angry because I took all this time to post the land, and I did it for a reason that was very important to me. And now I want to understand why you think it's okay to not pay attention to that. I want to understand why you've just crossed that line and you're hunting on this land and feel okay about it. Explain that to me. And I didn't come at him with, like, big anger. I just said, you know, I am angry. And but I want to still be able to keep that door of communication open. And the best way I've found to do that is to try to understand that person I'm talking to. It seems really key. Like, very often as activists, we think our job is to go out there and be understood. And I think our biggest job is to go out there and to understand. To go out there and understand, why would someone not choose what we're choosing? You know, what a fascinating study that is. So it worked really well on that land with the hunters to do that. You know, I didn't go out there and scream at them and say, you know, get the hell off my land. And, you know, and yet I did have anger. It's not like I denied it. I had it. And I said, okay, now I want to know, what's up with you? Why do you think it's okay? And, you know, that living on that land that was, you know, prime hunting land in the Midwest was such a good teacher for me. It brought in all of, I call them my hunting gurus. You know, all these teachers coming in to teach me, how am I going to communicate with them? You know, and there was a deer, and I felt like this deer was my close friend. I had planted apple trees on this land, and it turned out that the deer ate every apple that they could reach, and I had to get a special apple picking ladder to get to the very top of the tree in order to get any apples off my trees, and I would let them eat. And there was this one buck who was huge, and he'd come through every year, stand on his hind legs and eat all the apples that he could. And, you know, I thought, oh, okay, you know, I'll get the higher ones, you go for it. And, you know, after about 5 years of this, he came through the yard and he had an arrow through his back. He wasn't dead, but somebody, a bow hunter, had obviously shot him and not killed him. And he was suffering, and I could tell his breathing was labored, but he wasn't dead. And it was like I was watching this friend who I couldn't help, and he wouldn't let me near him, and I couldn't help him. And that the next year, a bow hunter came and actually asked permission. He came to the door and he said, can I hunt on your land? You know, I'm not a regular hunter, I'm a bow hunter. And I said, no. Then he got angry and was yelling at me that I must be from the city and, you know, all the typical things. And I said, well, actually, I'm not. And I said, do you want to know why I don't want you to hunt here? And he said, yes, I want to know why. We've been hunting here for generations. And I told him about my friend. And he just sat and he listened. You know, I said, can you understand that I had a relationship, a friendship? For me, it's a friendship with this being. And I want this to be a place where my friends can be without being harmed. It's just that simple. And he looked at me and he said, I get it. And I said, thank you. You know, he said, there's plenty of other places I can hunt. I said, thank you. Thank you for understanding. You know, I wanted just this place to be a sanctuary. So sometimes it's, you know, I might have the anger or the frustration or the sadness, and then I have to choose, when is it best to communicate that anger and when is it best to try and understand who I'm talking to? Because the bottom line for me is, what's really going to help other species? What's really going to help the environment? And if that's my bottom line, I have to hesitate sometimes before I react and say, okay, what is really going to help them? If everybody stopped in all actions and hesitated before we acted and said, okay, what do I really care about? And does what I'm about to say or do support that? Change everything.
I find sometimes with myself that people will know in advance before they meet me that I'm vegan or I'm doing animal rights stuff, and then they're defensive right away, and then I feel a bit of a loss. You know, how can I even begin a dialogue with you when you're already on the defensive? I find that to be a challenge, to say the least.
You know, it's a really wonderful thing you can do with that. It doesn't always work, but it often works. To just look at the situation and tell the person exactly, you know, we have often two dialogues going on. We have the one that's in our head, and then we have the one that we say. And the one that's in our head is often the one that's the more honest and would be the most effective. So sometimes in those situations, I say, you know, I feel some tension here. And I think that tension is probably because you have ideas about me because of my lifestyle, whatever that, you know, mm-hmm. those preconceived notions are. Is it true?
Hmm.
Do you have those feelings about me, or is this just because I've had so many bad experiences with it that I'm creating the situation?
Hmm.
Is it really true that you feel that about me? And you're calling it what it is right then. And it does this really beautiful thing. It puts you both on the same side in a way, instead of that you're adversaries. You're on the same side. You're saying, you know, what I really want to do is have a really connected conversation with you here. This is getting in the way for me right now. Can you help me get to a place where we can connect? And it works magic. And it can happen with anyone. Sometimes, you know, it's just like you feel like, oh, this situation is hopeless.
Yeah.
This person thinks, you know, I'm radical or I'm a terrorist or, you know, all these things that people will think if you choose compassion. It's just a little bit odd, isn't it? You know,
mm-hmm.
if you choose kindness, you may think you're a terrorist. But, you know, to just ask, oh, I'm getting this feeling from you. Is that the reality?
Mm-hmm.
And it really transforms it. It's really pretty amazing to do.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the speaking that you did at the 19th Annual Toronto Vegetarian Association Food Fair.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able to be at any of your talks, but I spoke with people who were, and I was really intrigued by the things that they were telling me. In particular, I think you were part of, or you ran a workshop called I Used to Be a Vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really caught the eye of a lot of people. Can you talk with us a little bit about what that workshop was about?
Mm. I got the idea for doing that workshop, I guess it was just this summer, and it came from two places. One is, if anyone is a vegetarian or vegan, you've heard this so many times. You know, as soon as somebody knows that you are a vegetarian, then it's like, you know, they're doing a confessional with you. Well,
mm-hmm.
I used to be, you know, and I'm not anymore. And
I don't eat much meat.
Yeah, exactly. I don't eat much, just a little bit.
I
don't
eat chicken.
Know, just, you know,
yeah.
fish, whatever, you know, all the different things that people say. But it's so common to hear those. And I thought, usually people are stumped when they hear that. They don't know how to respond. So I wanted to help people in terms of, how do you respond when someone says that to you? I used to be a vegetarian. Do you just let it go? Or what do you do with it? So that was one element I wanted to look at. The other one I wanted to look at is, what is it that keeps some people committed to that path and other people not?
Mm.
To really look at it, and what are the elements that keep people committed? And once we have figured out what those are, how do each of us individually support those around us, in the people around us and in the communities around us? So that was another part of it. And then the other part of it for me that was really motivating and having that workshop was, when I was in Sweden this summer, I had, after 20 years of being vegan, I started eating dairy products, and then I stopped, but I had this period where I was eating them, and I thought, wow, I wonder what this is about after 20 years, you know, it's a little bit crazy.
Mm.
And then I had to look at, with all I know, I teach this stuff, with all I know, what wasn't there for me in terms of staying on that path that I've been so true to. And I got to look at what the elements were, and then in each workshop I've done of I Used to Be a Vegetarian, people come up with those same three elements.
Mm.
And one of them is to have a supportive community around other people who are vegan or vegetarian, preferably vegan. And the other one was availability of the food, ease of cooking it, you know, not always being the one who has to bring in weird food, or, you know, having stores available that have that food for us, so it's not a big project. You know, I found in Sweden I had to go to four different stores to find my food, and it still wasn't quite what I wanted.
Wow.
You know, so it wasn't a very vegan supporting area. And then the other part, that third element, was to have constant reminders in front of us of the reality of these industries. During the summer when I was in Sweden, I wasn't looking at the videos all the time because I wasn't doing programs and I wasn't showing the pictures. I wasn't telling about the conditions in slaughterhouses and auctions and stockyards. And so I went into this, like, sleepy denial, which
mm-hmm.
is amazing considering I've done this work all these years. It's like, oh, God, it's just easier not to know. And so to have the constant reminders there of what the reality is, you know, instead of the little, you know, happy chickens that were on these billboards all over Sweden for this company that sells supposedly eggs from happy chickens, which I found out wasn't true when I visited the place. But I think those three elements are so important. And I'm actually glad that for that short time period, it was, you know, about a month or less than a month where I wasn't vegan. And so I got to experience, what is it like? You know, I'm really glad I experienced what is it that could possibly, like I used to think, there is nothing that could possibly make me not be vegan with all I know. It's impossible. And then this happened, and I went, okay, it is possible. And then I got to study it and look at it and look at my own life. And I have to say it felt great to get back to it because I want to live in alignment with what I know and with my values. And when I don't, I realized it was kind of depressing to go, I know the reality, and I'm not living in alignment with my values. And it doesn't feel good. So, yeah, so the workshops have been wonderful because people really get to give their input. And once we define those three elements, we all have the power to encourage those three elements in our communities and globally, to make sure that the information is out there for people, that they're seeing the reality, even if it's just making sure there's pamphlets in libraries and at natural food stores, wherever, just getting the information out there, or showing a video once a month and having it open to the public. Just make sure the information's continually out there. So we all have that ability to do that. We also have the ability to be inviting as a community to people, to make being vegan really inviting. And then in terms of availability of food, we all have the ability to influence the stores that we shop at so much. You know, like if 10 people start asking for a product, they're going to listen. They're going to say, okay, maybe we ought to consider this.
Those are great tips. We're going to play an ad, and then we'll come back and talk with you a bit more about your journey into these issues. And I'd love to hear about your plans for the future and where you see, I guess, the social justice movements going, animal rights movement going, the environmental movement, looking to the future. So we're going to come back with Ray Sikora on Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I wanted to make sure that we gave some airtime to some of the projects that you're involved with and that people could maybe look into a bit more if they're interested in finding out more about your perspective. In particular, I was thinking about the Simply Enough initiative, as well as your, I guess, past involvement with the International Institute for Humane Education.
Sure, and kind of put it into a nutshell.
Okay.
Some years ago, and it was so funny to hear you like try to figure out how many years now I've been doing this, because I try to do the same.
Right.
You know, and it depends when you start. You know, the first program I ever did, I was 18, and now I'm 47, and I'm embarrassed to think back on those programs when I was 18 because I was so shy and, you know, afraid to do any public speaking, and it was all new for me. But my motivation was that I cared so much for other species, and so I kept doing programs, and eventually I realized, oh, this is what my work is supposed to be. And I realized that this is not the work that is necessarily going to fill my bank account, but this is the work that is going to make me feel wealthy in a whole other way. It's going to add this richness to my life. And that ended up really becoming what the work was, kind of like redefining wealth. You know, what is wealth? And what do our lives look like if we're not caring for the planet and for other species? And so then I left the Midwest, and I was working for American Anti-Vivisection Society in their Animal Learn program, doing school programs. And I went from there. I left with the person who started Animal Learn, Zoe Weil. She and I left American Anti-Vivisection and headed up to Maine and started the Center for Compassionate Living, which eventually became the International Institute for Humane Education. And we both had the same idea that being an activist is wonderful and caring about the issues is wonderful, but we wanted to see, oh, what is the preventative work? Because in a way, being an activist, you're dealing with the symptoms. So we were both really interested in what is the prevention? Mm-hmm. You know, we thought it's education. How do you prevent these situations from ever developing where then you need activists in order to call attention to it? So we both started to focus on humane education, and humane education had been defined as basically caring for companion animals, and we realized it was so much more. So we took it upon ourselves to redefine humane education. You know, it's like, okay, there's no legal definition. Let's redefine it. And so we did. And the International Institute is doing great. It's still in Maine. And I chose about a year ago to leave the organization. And people said, you can't leave the organization. You started it. And I said, oh, yeah, I can leave it. It'll be fine. It'll thrive without me. And I wanted to head a different direction. I wanted to really look at how can I get these issues to people who aren't coming and looking for humane education. And when I started Simply Enough a year ago, it was with the idea that if I did consumer programs, a lot of simplifying our lives and looking at just helping people look at who and what do they care about and do their lives really reflect it. You know, people get all excited and they put banners up in schools, you know, for Earth Week. But then if you look around at the actions of the school, you know, like sometimes you see that school lunch menu right underneath it has all kinds of meat, and, you know, it's not a menu that's great for other species or the environment. So how do we really get our lives in alignment with who and what we care about? And I wanted to do it more broad-based because there's a bigger audience that way. I mean, I get invited to do consumerism programs and programs on simplifying your life that are from people who would never ask for a humane education program. You know, I would never ask for an animal rights program or an environmental program, but they get the same information. And on the website that I have for Simply Enough, there's a little wallet card that people can print out. And that little simple thing, that wallet card, it's a card that you use before you make any purchase. And you just stop yourself and you look at this card. And you ask yourself the questions on the card, and the first one is it a want or a need? And I don't know if I'm getting these in order because I'm not looking at the card, but the second one is something like, how does purchasing this product affect other species, the environment, my own health, other cultures? And to just really ask ourselves before we spend money on things and before we do any actions, does this support what I care about? And that's kind of the crux of Simply Enough. And I also was really wanting to go in that direction because I think, you know, like when I saw the WTO protests in Seattle, and I thought, this is the direction we're headed. We're not going to be all these separate little factions doing our work for these different areas because they're all connected. And that's the first time I saw everybody work together and come together to be one unified voice. And I think that's where we're headed. You know, and you see it in certain things like the really my favorite presidential hopeful in the U.S. right now is Denis Kucinich, and the guy is he's great. He's vegan, and, you know, he's into women's rights. He brings together all the issues, and I've never seen that before. You know, so I think we're headed that direction.
I know from going to these anti-globalization protests as well that it's a chance to really see allies in a lot of different movements, but it's also a challenge, I mean, in terms of, I'm thinking the iconography that's used, you know, pigs come to represent capitalists, and, you know, there's this real vilification of fat, and, you know, there are always sort of these fat pigs dressed up in business suits, and they're really, these images are really demonized.
Yeah, so much. It's funny you mentioned pigs because this takes such patience, you know, and I don't always have the patience. Sometimes I do, and it's not always a great situation to bring things up, and, you know, the police are there, and, you know, you're trying to have this nice chat with someone about, you know, what it means to, you know, have a speciesist attitude toward pigs, and you know, but sometimes you can. Sometimes it's a great situation for bringing it up. I called the Media Foundation, you know, Adbusters and the Media Foundation there in B.C., and I called because they have had these ads for years, and when they came out, I called them to represent the overconsumption in North America. They have a belching pig. That's how they represent it, you know, and so I called and I said, you know, I think that your ads are mostly really wonderful, but I wanted to talk to you about the one with the belching pig representing North America. And he said, well, what's the problem with that? And I said, well, it's quite speciesist. And he said, speciesist? What's that? And here, this was Adbuster, you know. And I said, oh, I said, do you want me to explain? And he said, yes. And I explained. He said, I never considered that. I never even considered that. I said, will you pass the information along? He said, yes, of course. And I think it requires just a lot of patience on our part. I think we have the opportunity to really help each other become more compassionate. You know, there was a woman who came into a booth I was tabling at this big fair, and I had a monitor with footage of downed animals being dragged off a truck. And this woman looked horrified. And she came over, and my booth was filled with people, and she came over and she stood right in front of me and she said, I'm not a vegetarian. Does that mean I'm not compassionate? And I thought, how do I want to answer this? And everybody stopped what they were doing in the booth and listened to hear what my answer was going to be. And I said, you know, I don't know. I don't know you. I don't know how compassionate you are or you aren't. I said, but I have a question for you. In my work, I fly on airplanes all the time, and it's one of the most environmentally unsound things that someone can do. So does that mean I'm not compassionate? And she smiled and she said, I don't know. I don't know you. And I said, you know, we have this wonderful opportunity. I can share with you ways that I know represent compassionate living. You can share them with me. I'm assuming you have ways you're compassionate that I'm not. And I have ways I'm compassionate that you are not. And when we're open to sharing those and hearing each other, we both become more compassionate. And that just seems like the key to me when all of these different factions are coming together, is that we stay open to hearing the different ideas, that I'm open to listening to the people who are working so hard on sweatshop issues, and they're open to me on animal issues, and we all really are better people for it.
We only have a few more minutes left, Ray. Why don't you, this is a question that I asked Zoe, actually, when she was on a while ago, who's from the International Institute for Humane Education. I said, how do you hang on to hope? Or do you have hope? And she said, well, one of the ways you can hang on to hope or be hopeful is through humane education, which was a great plug, and I had already been convinced long ago. But I'm just curious for you, how do you hang on to hope?
I think I have a variety of ways. The main way that I do it is I make sure that I don't always look forward at how far we have to go. I try to, at the same time, look back at how far we've come, because we've come so far, you know. I call and I make a reservation for a plane, and I say, you know, vegetarian, and they say the word vegan back to me. Do you want vegan? You know, just saying vegetarian was weird 20 years ago. And now it's not anymore. And, you know, we've come a long way in lots of areas. And so I try to look at our victories and celebrate those. I think one of the other things that gives me hope is seeing all of the people who are younger than I am, who are using humor and compassion and incredible creativity to bring these issues to the public. I get such hope from that. When I was just in Toronto at the food fair, I met all these young people who were doing amazing things, and that makes me hopeful. I just think it's great. And the other thing for hope is I try to remember all the beauty that's around, because so much of my work is looking at the ugly parts, or what I call ugly parts. And so I walk my dogs 2 hours a day and soak up the beauty whenever I can, because they're both there, you know, and it's important to keep seeing both.
Ray, thanks so much for being on today.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Your website, it's www.simplyenough.com, correct?
Yes.
And so people can contact you through there or find out more about the organization that way?
Yes. And when I move to Sweden, it'll still be Simply Enough in the same website and same email.
Okay, great. Have fun in Sweden.
Thank you so much.
We'll miss you on this continent.
I'll be coming back.
Yeah.
Coming back to do programs regularly. So hopefully we'll cross paths.
Grace, it was a pleasure, a thrill, an honor to have you on today. Really, Ray, you have served as an inspiration for so many people, including myself, and just wanted to say thanks again for your amazing work.
Oh, thank you for your work and all you do.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5. If you have questions or comments for Animal Voices, do write us, animalvoices@ciut.fm. Thanks to Sue and Lamia for coming in today.